In 1644, when the Manchu Qing dynasty overthrew the native Ming dynasty, one of the first things they did to show their control of the country was try to abolish foot binding among Chinese women. This was a total failure.
Yes, it was the first time, actually, that foot binding went out of just being for the upper class women and drifted all the way down to the peasant class, to farmers, to maids, to servants, because women saw it as an act of rebellion against the Manchus. And unlike men, who were very visible and would go out onto the streets, they had been ordered to wear a queue, a long pigtail. And if they didn't do that, they could have their heads cut off. But women were, for the most part, inside, and people didn't see them. And so they could still bind their feet and see it as an act of rebellion. And this policy was such a failure for the Manchus that they overturned it 5 years later. But more than that, the Manchu women didn't bind their feet. They had large natural feet, but they were very fashion conscious, just like many women are today. And so they used to build these little 3-inch platforms underneath their normal sized feet so that they would give the illusion of having bound feet.
The main character in Peony and Love, let's call her Peony, is totally caught up in this world of the traditional upper-class Chinese life. She has never been permitted outside of her family's compound, and it's not really till after she dies, I think we can let the readers know that she dies fairly early in the book, that she really discovers what the outside world is like. And she discovers that her parents, her father, she thought had been a strong opponent to the Manchus, but maybe had to give in more than he wanted, and that her mother had maybe been much braver. She led a very, very sheltered life.
Many women did at that time. They lived in these large compound homes with, let's say, 100 of their closest relatives, plus about another 100 servants, cooks, amas, gardeners to take care of them. And they were all within, you know, four walls of a very large compound. When I was doing the research, one of the things that struck me, going to the compound that still exists in China, is that many of them would have in the garden what was called a girls' viewing pavilion. This was just a small pavilion built up on a small hill, artificially made hill, where unmarried girls could go, and they could, from this pavilion, they could see but not be seen. So they could see who was coming in the front gate, they could see people wandering through the compound, and in some of these compounds, the pavilion was just high enough that these girls and their mothers could actually peek out over the compound wall. And for many of them, this was the only way they ever saw the outside world. Because even when they were married and they went to their husband's homes, they would be put into sedan chairs, palanquins that were completely covered so that they wouldn't even see outside the window. They left their family home and went to their husband's home.
One of Peony's first exposures to the outside world is when her father has the audacity to stage a private performance of the most popular opera of the time, the Peony Pavilion, in his compound, and invite many dignified, many important contemporaries and acquaintances to see it over a three-night period. Peony is not allowed to mingle with any of these people. She and her female relatives all have to stay in their own quarters and see what they can through at a very odd perspective.
Right. Women were not allowed to see operas or any kind of theatrical production at that time. The only way, and this was actually very rare, was if the men would allow them to sit behind a screen or a curtain. So even then, they wouldn't actually be able to see the production. They could only hear it. And for Peony, she manages to sit in such a way that she can peek through a crack in the screen and just see this little sliver of the opera.
And what she does see, and one of the audience members she sees, somehow incites her to not rebel overtly, but to sneak away and go into parts of the compound she's never been in before. And this leads to all the developments that totally alter her life.
That's right. That's right. Well, you know, young women, sometimes they do things they shouldn't, and then there's some consequences. But she does break away, and I think in some ways, although she has been cloistered by her family, her father has taught her to read, to write, to criticize. He has a very large collection himself of women's writings from that time. And I think that he, as many fathers did in this mid-17th century, 30-year period, a unique little aberration out of 5,000 years of history, were trying to get women to think, to expand what they knew, and then to get them to share what they were experiencing. So her father, in many ways, is not what you would consider a traditional Chinese father, because he was encouraging this in her, even as her mother was saying she shouldn't see the opera, she shouldn't read books, she shouldn't learn to read and write.
And the particular opera she does see, the Peony Pavilion, is just rife with provocative scenes. It involves lovers who should never have been lovers according to the normal circumstances, the death of one, returning as ghosts, and all sorts of supernatural, very emotional situations. This opera already had the reputation of causing young girls to stop eating and to imitate the heroine in a way, becoming lovesick maidens. You would think that maybe her parents might have anticipated this.
Well, yes, you would, but apparently not that many families did anticipate that in the 17th century, because there was such a widespread embracing of this opera by young women ages 13 to 16 who usually were not allowed to see the opera, could only read it. And when they caught it, they did catch cases of lovesickness and waste away and die. And as they were dying, they would write poems and stories that were then published after their death. And many of those works are still available to us today, not only in Chinese, but in English. And what these young women were doing in copying the main character from the opera was they were embracing the fact that she had actually been able to make choices in her life. Lin Yang, who's the main character in the Peony Pavilion, she is the first character in the history of Chinese literature, a woman, to make her own choices and to find her own husband and to fall in love. Very, very unique. And so when these real living girls read this story, something started to happen in their mind. You know, from the moment they were born, they were told things like, you're a worthless branch on the family tree. They had their feet bound when they were 5 or 6 years old, their toes broken, their midfoot broken, their foot kind of rolled up like you'd roll up a sock, until all that was left for a little girl and then later as a woman to walk on was basically her big toe. And the way to visualize an ideal-sized bound foot is just to look at your own thumb, about 1 inch wide and 3 inches long. And once this was done at 7, then the fathers would arrange a marriage. She might not go into that marriage right away, maybe when she turned 15 or 16, but once she got to her husband's home, sight unseen, with no choice whatsoever or voice in this decision, she would be told, have a son, have a son, have a son. And if she didn't have a son, she could be sold into another marriage. She could be discarded out onto the street. So, again, as I said, when these living girls read this opera, where a young woman makes her own choices and determines her own future and it also has to do with love, this one emotion that these young girls in real life thought that they would never have a chance to experience, that they would never receive it, and that they would never really be able to give it, they thought, perhaps in death, perhaps only in death, will I ever experience love, this one emotion that all of us want even today.
And as it turned out, there were three historical women who experienced all of this while being serially married to the same man, and who eventually wrote serial commentaries to the Peony Pavilion Opera. That's a rather amazing coincidence.
Yes, there was first the young woman, Chen Tong, with her name in real life, but in my novel her name is Peony, who did have a case of lovesickness, and as she was dying, she would write her thoughts about love in the margins of one copy of the Peony Pavilion. And after she died, this was given to the man she was supposed to marry, who gave it to his next wife 10 years later, a 16-year-old girl, who started adding her thoughts about love in the same copy of the Peony Pavilion. And after she died, he waited another 10 years or so. By this time, he was in his 40s. She was then the new third wife, was only 16. And he must have been a bit of an idiot, let's be frank, because he gave her that same copy of the Peony Pavilion, and she started adding her thoughts about love in the margins. But she was unlike her predecessors, and she took all of her wedding jewelry and pawned it and used the money so that this book could be published as what was called The Three Wives Commentary of the Peony Pavilion. And this book was the first of its kind to have been written and published anywhere in the world by women, and it has remained in print in China for 300 years.
One of the fascinations of the plot is that the first wife, Peony, dies a third of the way through, and most of the remaining book is told from her point of view as a hungry ghost. The Chinese believe that the soul divides into three parts after its death, and if one of them it is not properly enrolled to become an ancestor, it will wander as a hungry ghost. And so we see everything from the point of view of a woman who'd been incredibly privileged and sheltered to being thrown into an afterworld of chaos, greed, conflict of all sorts, and then observing the living remaining people as well.
Yes, that's right. In a sense, I was following the plot of the opera of the Peony Pavilion, because in that opera, the main character does become a ghost as well. But also, I've been really intrigued by this idea that the Chinese have, that there are some emotions that are so strong that they transcend borders, they transcend time, and they do transcend this veil between life and death. And there are seven of them in particular that travel with you into the afterworld, and that you still experience them in the afterworld, that all of that comes with you. And I really wanted to explore that idea of emotions being so strong that they transcend death. But also, the Chinese afterworld is very, very different from Western concepts of what happens to you after you die. And it is a very full world. It's almost like a parallel world to ours, because ancestors, those in the afterworld, in the afterlife, still have all the same needs, wants, and desires as they had in life. And so, you know, we just had Chinese New Year, right? Well, so much of Chinese New Year really is about honoring your ancestors and providing to your ancestors food, money, housing, clothes, these days iPods and computers and cell phones, which are often made out of paper and then burned so that they will then travel to the afterworld where your ancestors will use them. And if you give them proper offerings, they will reward you in the coming new year with children, a good job, happiness, prosperity. So I think that the idea of taking something that we sort of know about, you know, we know that people celebrate Chinese New Year, but we don't really know what's behind it. We know that there are other holidays throughout the year that the Chinese celebrate. Many of them, again, have to do with this interaction between the living and the dead. I just wanted to live in that world for a while, but also sort of open it up to people in the West so that they could experience it a little bit.
I've read many analyses of Chinese ghost beliefs, and I've read quite a few short Chinese stories, but I've never read anything as comprehensive as this. And one of the things I most liked about it was that it put all these concepts I'd heard of into a very concrete situation.
Well, thank you very much. You know, you're right that that world does have a lot of rules. You know, for example, ghosts are not allowed, can't turn corners. And this is something that you see has an effect in so many aspects of Chinese life, even today. You know, in right now, today, in modern times, you'll see zigzag bridges in gardens which have an aesthetic purpose, but they also are there because ghosts can't cross them. For roads to small villages, there's never a straight road to a village because ghosts can travel in a straight direction. There are all kinds of twists and turns to get to a village. But this is true even for major cities, where now there are superhighways that will go into those major cities, but they do have these turns because ghosts can travel in a straight line. So I had to sort of deal with, how do you get around that, you know, if you're a ghost? Well, there wouldn't be ghost stories in China if ghosts hadn't been able to figure out a way to make those turns. So there were a lot of instances like that where I was taking the belief and either finding some kind of a historical record for how ghosts did it, or just working in a practical, thinking in a practical way about how would I do that if I were a ghost and I wasn't able to turn a corner? What would I do? How would I get around it?
And at the very end of the novel, Peony is finally released from being a hungry ghost because the third wife follows patterns, follows a ritual that she had taken from the Peony Pavilion, and this leads to the discovery that she had never been properly enrolled as an ancestor, and she finally gets so.
Right. Yes, that's right. But I think the other thing that happens there is the ghost marriage. Now, a lot of people who have read Peony in Love have asked me, do ghost marriage, when did ghost marriages stop happening in China? Well, you know, they still are performed in China, in mainland China, in Hong Kong, in Taiwan, and even here in this country by some people. And this is when, following the belief that even in death, you should be married and you should have a spouse. So, for example, if you have an infant son who dies, you want him to have a spouse, a wife, to take care of him in the afterworld. And so he might be married to another girl or woman who has also already died, so that the two of them can be married in the afterworld. And it is a very complex in some ways, but also a very straightforward ceremony that is almost identical to a living wedding.